Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, December 28th, 2017. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. And let's get started here. Haida launch a blockade against logging close to Newtown in Canada, in this story by Andrew Hudson of the Haida Gwaii Observer, reposted to the Warrior Publications and found on the Earth First Newswire. Fallers heading to work on a cut block near Newtown yesterday morning found the old Masset flag and dozens of residents at the gate. The night before, newly elected Chief Counselor Duffy Edgars went door-to-door through the village to gather support from chiefs and elders and rally people for the blockade. About 50 people turned out before workers arrived at 7:30 in the morning. "I think this is a first for Old Masset. It's in our backyard," Edgars said, noting that it's the first time Old Masset Council has opposed such a logging plan. All of Council was against the logging there because of the surroundings, and it's supposed to be part of a community forest, he said. Sold by BC Timber Sales in March of 2016, the contract includes 15,427 cubic meters of timber with a stumpage value of $341,000. O'Brien and First Logging won the contract and was approved by the province, but not by the Council of the Haida Nations at the solutions table. One of the planned cut blocks is east of Newtown. Tiaga Guadalas and Old Masset Concilers are concerned that logging will exacerbate the risk of flooding in the neighborhood, which already has flooded streets last winter. However, BCTS contracted a hydrologist who found that logging the cutback wouldn't pose any significant risk. Besides the flooding issue, Old Masset Councilors and the Council of Haida Nations also object to the sale because it is an easy-access, high-value set of cut blocks that they would rather benefit the nearby community directly. When they first rejected the sale in 2016, CHN said they would share the underlying public concern that the most accessible cedar-rich forests near Haida Gwaii communities are being logged too quickly. CHN is also concerned that too much cedar is being targeted, which will lead to a gap when no mature cedar is available for local forestry companies. Similar issues led to another solutions table impasse and a CHN no logging signs posted in November by planned cutbacks in the Nadu Road and Lawn Hill areas. BC Forest Minister Doug Donaldson was not available for an interview, but a spokesperson said by email that the ministry will try to address the concerns over the coming weeks. The new NDP government hopes to build on a strong relationship with the CHN and the Haida Gwaii communities, the ministry said, noting that Minister Donaldson and the local MLA Jennifer Rice met by phone with Haida Nation President Peter Lantine on November 28th. But the ministry also said the current logging is happening closer to Haida Gwaii communities because other areas of special importance were set aside as part of the Haida Gwaii Strategic Land Use Agreement. The spokesperson noted that 52% of the Haida Gwaii is now in protected areas, while another 18.5% is protected through the Haida Gwaii Land Use Objectives Order. On the cedar question, the ministry said the chief forester recognized the problem in 2012 when she set a voluntary cap on cedar harvesting for the major timber company operating in the Haida Gwaii area. Actual forests have been within the limits, said the ministry, with the exception of one area where the chief forester is setting a hard cedar limit on the recommendation of the Haida Gwaii Management Council. And a Sea Shepherd night time drone has been shot down by poachers in this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Ocean conservation group Sea Shepherd was surprised by gunfire on Christmas Eve, which resulted in a drone being shot down by poachers in the Gulf of California of Mexico. Sea Shepherd vessel Don Paul DeJoria was on patrol looking for poachers when its crew observed suspicious activity on the radar at 9:30 on December 24th. The vessel is currently in the Upper Gulf for Operation Milagro 4, which protects the critically endangered vaquita porpoise and totoaba bass. Captain Benoit Sandigian directed the Sea Shepherd crew to fly the night vision drone to investigate the targets. Three skiffs were moving through the gillnet exclusion zone. Poachers often conceal themselves in the cover of night, which is what we suspected to be the case here, said the captain of the motor vessel Jean-Paul de Joria. The poachers were targeting a critically endangered totoaba fish in order to harvest the swim bladder. Much like shark fins, these bladders are sought for their alleged medicinal properties and are sold in black markets in China and Hong Kong for the tens of thousands of dollars. Poachers set gill nets to catch totoaba, but the nets catch everything in their path, including the most endangered marine mammal in the world, the elusive vaquita porpoise. The conservationist drone had traveled approximately 2.8 nautical miles from the vessel and was hovering above a suspicious skiff when five gunshots rang out across the sea. Upon reviewing footage from the incident, the crew confirmed that one of the individuals in the skiff was in possession of a firearm. The crew replaced the drone's batteries and immediately took to the sky once more to inspect another skiff 1.4 nautical miles away. At this point, they lowered the Matrice drone to 100 feet in order to get a better look at the suspect vessel. 13 gunshots were fired, and instantly the drone's monitor went dark, reading disconnected. "Our drone was shot down," said drone operator Jack Hutton. "The poachers don't want us looking at them, even if it means making use of automatic weapons, reaching a new level of violence." In the past, poachers have attempted to strike Sea Shepherd's drones with rocks, bricks, and even fish. However, this incident is the first time that drones have been shot at. Sea Shepherd president and founder Captain Paul Watson has always maintained that the camera is the organization's greatest weapon. It is no secret to poachers that the video drone is critical to Sea Shepherd in saving the vaquita porpoise from extinction by finding the location of illegal nets and recovering them. The tension has been increasing in the fight to save the vaquita, which is endemic to the Gulf of California. Scientists estimate that there are less than 30 vaquitas in existence. Earlier this year, at a demonstration, a group of fishermen took a small skiff, painted the word Sea Shepherd on it, and burned it in the streets of San Felipe's fishing village. Sea Shepherd is working with Mexican authorities and the Mexican Navy to patrol the area and recover illegal gillnets on its fourth season of Operation Milagro. "We are not going anywhere," said Captain Sanjian. "We will not be intimidated by these threats. The vaquita needs us, and so does the long list of species impacted by poachers in the Sea of Cortez. For as long as there are illegal nets in these waters, the Sea Shepherd will be there to pull them out." And you can get more information at www.seashepherd.org. And accidentally killing migratory birds is not a crime, the Trump administration has said in this story from the Environment section of Reuters, story written by Laura Zuckerman. Energy companies and other businesses that accidentally kill migratory birds will no longer be criminally prosecuted, the Trump administration said last Friday in a decision hailed by the industry but denounced by environmental groups. The decision in a legal memo from the U.S. Department of Interior reverses a long-standing practice at the agency as well as a last-minute rule released by the outgoing Obama administration. It comes after several appeals in courts ruled that the government was interpreting a century-old law aimed at protecting birds too broadly. "Christmas came early for bird killers," said David O'Neill, chief conservation officer for the National Audubon Society. The White House is parting ways with more than 100 years of conservation legacy. The administration's move is the latest of several actions Trump has taken to weaken environmental protections viewed as burdensome to industry, including shrinking the size of two national monuments in Utah and reconsidering protections for the greater sage grouse, a western bird whose population has dropped precipitously amid threats to its habitat. In the legal opinion issued late Friday, the Interior Department's principal Deputy Solicitor Daniel Giorgiani said that a 1918 law that officials have used to prosecute those who kill birds incidentally as part of doing business is really aimed at preventing poaching and hunting without a license. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act applies only to direct and affirmative purposeful actions that reduce migratory birds, their eggs, or their nests by killing or capturing to human control, Jacquiri wrote. His opinion reverses a January effort by the outgoing former President Barack Obama to encode the Interior Department's ability to prosecute those who accidentally kill migratory birds, which never went into effect as it was suspended shortly after Trump came into office. But it also makes clear that law enforcement officials working for the department are not to attempt to file criminal charges in such cases, which Giorgiani said would be a change in the agency's practices. Kathleen Sagama, president of the Western Energy Alliance, said oil and gas companies protect birds every day and accused the Obama administration of abusing the law by making companies criminally liable. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act was enacted by Congress as a criminal statute to stop the hunting and poaching of migratory birds, she said in a statement. It was not meant to address activities that do not directly kill birds. But environmentalists predicted the Trump administration's decision meant no accountability for the deaths of otherwise unprotected birds, from songbirds to falcons. The Interior Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment from Reuters. Alaska's Pebble Mine Project has kicked off the permitting process. In this story from Reuters Environment News, written by Yareth Rosen and Susan Taylor, the would-be developer of the widely opposed Pebble Mine Copper and Gold Project in salmon-rich southwestern Alaska announced on Thursday that it will file its first application for a permit. The application is a milestone for a project that seemed dead during the Obama administration but is now moving forward under President Donald Trump, a champion of increased domestic mining. The Pebble Limited Partnership, led by Northern Dynasty Minerals Limited, said it would submit an application Friday to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a wetlands fill permit, a key authorization required under the Clean Water Act. For the Pebble team, this day has been a long time in the making, and as a result of a tremendous amount of hard work, Tom Collier, chief executive of the Pebble Partnership, said in a statement. The Pebble Mine, proposed for more than a decade, is the world's largest undeveloped gold and copper project. Located in Alaska's Bristol Bay region, the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery, it has drawn opposition from environmentalists, some native groups, and sport fishermen. The Obama administration's Environmental Protection Agency had blocked the project in 2014, even before a permit application had been filed, a move reversed by the current EPA this year. The permit application announcement comes 3 days after the partnership said it gained a new member, First Quantum Minerals, the world's eighth biggest copper producer, which will acquire an option to buy a 50% stake in the project for $1.5 billion. For 4 years, the partnership has been limited to Northern Dynasty, whose previous partner, Anglo-American, dropped out in 2013. On Thursday, Northern Dynasty outlined a scaled-back plan for the mine to address concerns about the salmon fishery, reducing its footprint and announcing no primary main operations will be located in the upper Telluric watershed. Not only are we confident the Pebble is currently envisioned will secure development permits from federal, state, and regulatory agencies, we are confident it will coexist with world-class fisheries in Bristol Bay, Collier said. The company estimated the Pebble mine operations will produce annual payments of $49 to $66 million to Alaskan coffers and create 1,500 to 2,000 direct and indirect jobs. Opponents, however, vowed to continue their fight. In a joint statement, native organizations, a commercial fishing spokesman, and the environmental group Trout Unlimited, and the Speaker of the Alaskan House of Representatives condemned the proposal. The vast majority of the people I serve are more resolved than ever in their determination to protect their livelihoods and their way of life, House Speaker Bryce Edgman said in the statement. And the Nature Conservancy has established a 24,000-acre California Coastal Preserve, a swath of California coastal land that the LA Times once called the last perfect place is going to remain perfect thanks to the Nature Conservancy. Using a $165 million donation from Jack and Laura Dangermond, co-founders of the Geographic Information Systems and Mapping Company Esri, the Nature Conservancy purchased and is now permanently protecting over 24,000-acre Coho Jalama Ranch, also known as Bixby Ranch, at Point Conception in Santa Barbara County. This is an incredibly rare, ecologically important place with 8 miles of coast and centuries-old coast oak woodlands, Jack Dangerman said in a Nature Conservancy statement announcing the creation of the preserve. This preserve to be preserved and managed by an organization like the Nature Conservancy, the preserve will be named after the Dangermans. The preserve, according to The Atlantic, include hills, canyons, grasslands, creeks, part of the Santa Ynez mountain range, possibly 1 million live oak trees, and the coastline around Point Conception. The land here is shockingly pristine. While cattle have grazed on the land since the late 1800s, the area has never been developed much beyond that. So there aren't malls of any kind, and there aren't any ostentatious homes of the wealthy centered around a stunning view. There's just wilderness, a unique thing in this day and age of rapid commercial development. And with that wilderness comes another unique thing about the Jack and Laura Dangerman Preserve, its wildlife. The preserve marks a place where northern and southern California ecosystems transition. For California's wildlife, it marks either the southernmost or northernmost parts of their respective ranges, and this makes it one of the most biodiverse parts of California, Mark Reynolds of the Nature Conservancy scientists overseeing the acquisition told National Geographic. The property is also adjacent to the Los Padres National Forest and other protected areas. The result is an important wildlife corridor for bears, mountain lions, and bobcats. 14 threatened and endangered species like snowy plover, red-legged frog, and monarch butterfly call the preserve home. The blended environments aren't just on the land, though. The ocean is also a biodiversity hotspot. The cold northern waters of the Pacific mix with the warmer waters of the coast, and the result is a diverse marine environment where sea mammals can swim without concern of human interference. With this huge mixing, you have a rookery of seals, big whales, all the elements of a hugely diverse marine reserve, Jack Dangerman told The Atlantic. Basically, if you're looking for the wildlife that California has to offer, it's here in the preserve. And a fungal disease poses a global threat to snakes in this story from the BBC Science and Environment News Service, as written by Matt McGrath. A potentially deadly fungal disease poses a significant threat to snakes all over the world, new research suggests. The pathogen, which has been found in 23 species of wild snakes in the U.S. and 3 in Europe. The fungus causes lesions on the snake's body, leading to infection and death. The study argues that all snakes could become or are already infected. The report has been published by the Journal of Science Advances. Fungal infections have had devastating impacts on a number of different species in the recent years. Chytrid fungus has reduced frog populations all around the world, while weight nose syndrome has killed millions of bats in the United States. New researchers have evidence of what's termed snake fungal disease in a number of populations in Europe and the U.S. Found predominantly in rat snakes, milk snakes, garter snakes, and vipers of eastern parts of the U.S., it has also been detected in Europe, including the United Kingdom. The disease forms lesions on the snake's skin and can spread quickly and cover a large part of the body. They start getting these blisters and then all kinds of secondary infections from it. It can kill snakes quite rapidly, actually. I've seen them go down in a matter of a few days, said lead author Frank Berbrink from the American Museum of Natural History. The demographic of the disease and how it's really working across all these species and populations are unknown, but we do know that it can take populations down. It can have 100% mortality in some areas. While molting can help the animal, many die from infections. This fungus also causes changes in the behavior of snakes, causing them to spend more time basking in the sun as their skin molts, putting them at greater risk of starvation and attack from predators. To work out the possible extent of the threat, scientists built a model based on the evolutionary history, ecology, and physical traits of known infected species. They look for associations that could be used to predict which species might be susceptible. The results showed that all 98 groups of snakes in the eastern United States could be at risk, and the epidemic might extend globally. There were captive snakes in Great Britain from the 1980s that we knew had this, but it wasn't until 2015 my co-author actually infected them in controlled studies, said Dr. Burbrink. We don't really know if it's going to get worse all of a sudden, but there are a lot of question marks. We have got to get started to get a handle on this and assess how really bad this is. We know it can be bad, but we don't know how bad it really is. The researchers want other scientists involved with snake studies around the world to keep an eye out for symptoms and evidence of the infection. Scientists have learned a lot about research and monitoring needs from 25 years of studying the effects of citrid fungi on amphibians, and those lessons tell us that prevention is the best policy, said co-author Karen Lipps, a professor of biology at the University of Maryland in College Park. And a West African dolphin is now listed as one of Africa's rarest mammals. The Atlantic humpback dolphin is now listed as critically endangered. A group of scientists now considers the little-known dolphin that only lives along the Atlantic coast of Western Africa to be among the continent's most endangered mammals, a list that includes widely recognized species such as gorillas, African wild dogs, and black rhinos, according to the Wildlife Conservation Society and the International Union for Conservation of Nature Cetacean Specialist Group. The latest assessment of the Atlantic humpback dolphin, Sousa terzuzi, reveals a new and most depressing reality. The obscure and poorly studied dolphin is now considered to be in great peril across most of its coastal range and has been uplisted from vulnerable to critically endangered on the IUCN's red list of threatened species. Growing up to 2.5 meters, that's more than 8 feet in length, the Atlantic humpback dolphin is gray in color and has a characteristic hump just below its dorsal fin. These dolphins are shy, occur in small groups, and rarely venture more than a few kilometers from shore. They are highly susceptible to human activities in coastal waters, and threats include entanglement in fishing gear, offshore construction such as port development, and hunting for human consumption. Our recent assessment suggests that the global population of the Atlantic humpback dolphin is likely numbers fewer than 1,500 breeding adults distributed among several isolated subpopulations, most of which appear to be very small, said Tim Collins of WCS's Ocean Giants Program and the Africa Coordinator of the IUCN Cetacean Specialist Group. The preserved range of the Atlantic humpback dolphin stretches more than 7,000 kilometers along the coastal areas of Western Sahara to Central Angola. The previous vulnerable listing for the species was based largely on the assumptions that dolphins were more abundant in the areas where the species was known to occur, and the presumption of occurrence in many areas had not been surveyed. For the new red list assessment, researchers conducted a thorough review of the available data, which strongly suggests that the dolphins occur in very low and apparently declining numbers throughout most or all of their range. Most populations are extremely small, and several appear to be isolated. Declines have been observed or are suspected for every known population, and their continued decline is considered inevitable given the ongoing expansion of identified threats throughout the species' known range. And ice will return, but extinctions can't be reversed, in this story from the BBC Environment News. Each day, increasingly dangerous hurricanes, wildfires, and floods betray the influence of climate change. We are appalled at the accruing losses of life and property. The arguments to address climate change in the recent UN climate conference in Bonn focused most often on these more concrete risks. However, the worst effects of climate change will come not from severe weather, but from the irreversible loss of species and ecosystems. Molded over millions of years by natural selection, the diversity of species on Earth does more than just inspire awe. They are technical marvels and solutions to problems that we do not yet know exist. Scientific evidence now suggests the Earth has embarked on its sixth extinction crisis, on par with those executed by extraterrestrial asteroids and geologic upheavals. But this time, humans are at fault. Most current extinctions ensue from land use and overexploitation, but climate change is now catching up and accelerating those risks. A couple of years ago, I began obsessively scanning thousands of scientific papers for extinctions predicted from climate change. I collected more than 500,000 predictions, including plants and animals from 7 continents and the ocean. Surprisingly, I found that species extinctions would not just increase with global warming, but would speed up in a rising arc. If we continue emitting current levels of greenhouse gases, climate change could threaten 16% of all species, and that's more than 1 million by 2100. Look out your window and count 6 different species, and now imagine that one is gone forever. We risk losing common backyard species like the salt marsh sparrow. About 50,000 of these yellow-cheeked birds nest precariously above high normal tide line along the east coast of the United States. U.S. scientists predict that climate-amplified tides will wipe this bird off the salt marsh and the earth in a few decades. And we are already losing the America pika, a rabbit-like creature adapted to life on the western North American mountaintops. Even mild temperatures at mid-20 degrees C, that's about 70 degrees, transform its alpine coat into a hairy death suit. Rising heat is pushing pikas to the top of the mountain where they have nowhere else to go, and they can't fly. We have just lost the Bramble K. melomnes. This beach rat lived on an Australian coral cay surrounded by the rising seas of climate change. Last year, scientists mounted a rescue mission but found nothing but a storm-swept island. And this story written by Mark Urban of the BBC. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. And this year, the Earth First Update is broadcast every Thursday evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio at 9 p.m. You can listen to a rebroadcast here on Freak Radio tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. Or you can listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, or KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California. All broadcast the Earth First Update. Check their schedules for time and date. Or you could listen online to Grateful Dread Public Radio, gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. That's gdprnashville.org. Or you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous version of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Uncle Dennis. Please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.